Thanks, Kim. Good morning, everybody. Let me begin by thanking QSA, Kim, and Janice Chi for inviting me to give today's presentation. The title of the paper obviously includes a metaphor. The metaphor was suggested to me when I was reading after Janice invited me to give a presentation. She sent me the papers that Rob Gilbert and Peter Freebody and others had completed. And you may recall that in Peter's paper there was a quote at the very beginning from John Milton. Thinking about John Milton and a poem that he wrote called, many of you have read it, I'm sure, Paradise Lost, the epic, great epic poem of the fall of man and the tree of knowledge. That suggested a metaphor to me that I decided would be fun to play with. So I started thinking about how I might do that when I was beginning to plan the paper. And I've not been able to kind of realize, I think, the rich potential of the metaphor. I don't have enough time to do that today, but it's something I'm going to work on in a later iteration of the paper. So let me begin with the book of Genesis. I'm not a religious person, so I'm not endorsing this as a particular theological statement, but as a kind of a core metaphor for the way we think about the human condition and about the nature of knowledge. And I'm sure many of you are familiar with this statement. And the Lord God planted the garden in Eden in the east, and there he put the man whom he had formed. And out of the ground the Lord God made to grow every tree that is pleasant to the sight and good for food, the tree of life also in the midst of the garden, and the tree of knowledge of good and evil. The Lord took God the man and put him in the Garden of Eden to tend and keep it. And the Lord God commanded the man, saying, "You may freely eat of every tree of the garden, but of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil you shall not eat, for in the day you shall eat, you shall die." Well, not being a particularly good Christian, I'm going to not follow that maxim at all and going to suggest something quite different. The image of the tree of knowledge, of course, has been a very powerful one in Western culture. And there are numerous, the iconography of this is pervasive throughout our culture, and we can see many images of the story. This is from the early 14th century, and you can see again this kind of the image of the tree of knowledge, and again the tree of knowledge not only of kind of the world, but of the word, and of good, the word of good of evil. This is another tree of knowledge that you might all be familiar with. It's a local tree of knowledge, now deceased, unfortunately. It was the foundation for those of you who were around for when the Labor Party, the first Labor Party meeting was held, quorum was held under this tree of knowledge in the outback in Queensland. This image, this metaphor, continues to pervade our culture in all sorts of interesting ways. This is a recent book on cognition, and you can see the metaphor being played out here. And of course, in the high-tech world, again, we can see the impact of this very powerful metaphor, and in the commercial world as well. This is a IT company in Melbourne that advertises using the tree of knowledge. So it's a really powerful image that runs right through our culture. So what am I going to do? I'm going to start with some general statements or design principles around curriculum design. And then I want to focus on a particular principle around the notion of disciplinarity. Now, I know you've had some discussions about that particularly. I know Peter, in his paper, raised that issue at some length, and I'm going to say some things about that. And then I'm going to talk about a particular model for a senior secondary syllabus that I've worked up. You know, given the kinds of constraints, the kind of issues that you have here in Queensland, and the kind of principles that you've indicated you wanted to adopt to frame the senior secondary syllabus. Then I want to finish off with some of the key implementation issues. I'm going to run through some of this fairly quickly, and some of it I'll spend more time on. The policy settings, you're all familiar with this. I'm not going to say much about it. I think these are very sensible principles. This is a very sensible proposal. I don't have any reservations at all about what the proposal one that the QSA has prepared. So I'm not going to say any more about that. I'm going to incorporate those principles in what I propose, and you'll see how I do that later on. There are certain kinds of assumptions and commitments that have been adopted as well that underpin the framework that QSA has adopted, and those too I'm going to simply accept as kind of parameters for the work that I'm going to suggest. The QSA framework has a clear rationale that you're all familiar with. It has a statement of key purposes that I'm going to say more about in a moment. And the first one focusing on the notion of the development of the whole person, and secondly upon post-school destinations broadly from education, work and adult life. Then the broad the design principles that have been mapped out, coherence, rigour, flexibility and connectivity. I endorse all of these principles. I have no reservations about them. I think they're sensible, powerful, coherent, and they will help drive, I think, a good, sensible curriculum development process. So I don't want to say anything particularly about those at this point. Let me say something then about the design principles over and above the ones that you've already mapped out in the documentation that you've prepared. I want to make three preliminary points about these design principles or about design, the process of design, curriculum design more broadly. The first is that the curriculum design is a matter of practical judgment in both the Aristotelian and the Kantian sense. It's not simply, in particular, it's not simply a matter of epistemological determinism, that we've got a map of knowledge and we simply map the curriculum onto the map of knowledge. There was a paper, a very influential paper, that an English philosopher, Paul Hirst, prepared in the 1960s that was about forms of understanding that had a huge impact on British and Australian and to some extent American debates in the 60s and 70s and 80s. And that reflected that kind of assumption that the curriculum ought to be built upon the structure of knowledge. And you know, that's an important part, important element of the way we think about the curriculum, and we can see the echoes of that, the resonances in the way that we think about knowledge and the curriculum. So it's not to be repudiated, but I think we need to be careful that the curriculum is more than simply a mapping of epistemology, of the structure of knowledge as such. And indeed that there are a range of normative, empirical, policy and even political considerations that need to be taken into account. This makes the process, I think, complex. It's not an easy task. You've got to bring all of these considerations into play and find a resolution that's sensible, coherent, and implementable. It also has to be principled. And I'm going to spend, in fact, some time talking about what those principles might be, because I think we can't simply have a dog's breakfast in the way, in the particular principles we put together. It has to be coherent, and it has to be consistent with our most fundamental assumptions and commitments about the value and purpose and the organisation of education. And in pursuing that argument, I want to sort of draw your attention to a distinction that's familiar to, I'm sure, to you all, between things that are instrumentally valuable and things that are intrinsically valuable. And I think that comes up particularly in the statement of principle. There's also Gabriel Matters prepared a paper. I actually haven't seen the paper, but in the Peter Freebody's paper, he quoted from that paper quite liberally and indicated these are a set of principles, design principles, that Gabriel had prepared for the QSA. I think this is, again, another very good set of principles, and I strongly endorse. I don't have any issues with any of those principles. I think there are issues about, well, what are the priorities? I mean, what's more important? How do you resolve conflicts and tensions between them? But that's for another day. The ones that I want to focus on today to do with a curriculum that has to be purposeful, it has to be existentially meaningful and valuable, it has to be intellectually coherent and rich, it has to be institutionally relevant and valuable, it has to be socially inclusive, and it has to be principled. So those are the key issues that I want to talk about. Then I want to talk about the issue of disciplinarity in some detail. And then towards the end, I want to talk about the proposal that I think you have in your package for the particular design that I would recommend for QSA to consider. Purposeful. Well, it's clear that I think QSA has indicated a strong commitment to a purposeful career, to a set of purposes that will guide curriculum development. And I think this is incredibly important because, and for a range of reasons. One is that if you don't have a clear set of purposes, what tends to happen is that subject matter takes over and you begin to organise the curriculum around subjects, around English and maths and history and the rest. And the kind of broader purposes that you want education to serve, or organising it around pathways, the broader purposes that you want education to serve get lost. And I think it's important to keep this in mind. This is your starting point, your point of departure. And I've quoted this before, so I endorse, I think this is a very strong statement, a very sensible statement, and I don't have any reservations about it. However, I want to amplify it in a number of ways. And I want to amplify it with a little normative theory. I happen to have a background in both history and philosophy, so I sometimes, in working these issues, I draw on that background. And here I'm going to draw on some work from John Rawls and Charles Taylor, who are both, Rawls is now deceased, but was an extremely influential American political and moral philosopher for the last half century. Charles Taylor is still alive, he's a Canadian. And I'm going to draw on some of their work in the way I kind of unpack these issues. In thinking about what it is to be a person, and thinking about what that means, what that commitment might mean to educators, I think we need to think about four kinds of issues. And in thinking about what it is to prepare for adult life, one way of framing it is, I think, around the development of four sets of capacities. The first one is about framing the good. Developing a sense of self and what's valuable to you, what kind of life you want to lead, what kind of person you want to be. It's also about developing the capacities that allow you to pursue the kind of conception of a good life you have and changes that you might, the revisions that you might make in that conception of a good life. So it's about developing the capacities that allow you to successfully pursue in the current institutional environment of workplaces, labour markets, communities, the state, to pursue the kinds of life that you think valuable. It also means that you need to be able to protect the kind of life or your interests that you have formed for yourself and that you pursue. And we normally, in a liberal democracy, we do that through liberal democratic political processes. You need to be able to represent and protect your interests in the political arena. That's a huge task of education in a politically informed view of a liberal democratic education. And then finally, education needs to be about developing those capacities that protect protection. Because liberal democratic institutions, the universal franchise, periodic elections, competitive parties, free press, the rule of law, are essentially about allow people to pursue their own good and to have that good represented in parliament or in decision-making bodies. The principle of political equality is the equal representation and consideration of interests. That's what the protecting the good is about. But the fourth one is about protecting the institutions that make protection possible. So it's about protecting, engaging in activities that protect the rule of law, that support through various ways parliamentary government, liberal democracy, tolerance, and so those principles that define a liberal democracy. So a liberal democratic education is one that attends to all four of these principles and not just one or two. Now, let me say a few words about framing the good. What does it mean? This is a question that has exercised philosophers and theologians from both from within the Christian Judeo-Christian tradition as well as Greek philosophy. We can see that, for example, in the book of Genesis, the whole issue about the tree of knowledge was the tree of knowledge was the fruit of good and evil. That was the key issue on which Adam and Eve had to wrestle with at that moment. And then in Greek moral philosophy, of course, there are two questions that they established as the core of the Western moral tradition, philosophical tradition. One was, what is the good? What does it mean to have a good life? What does a good life consist of? not the good life, but a good life? And secondly, what is the right thing to do? What is justice? And those are the two questions that have dominated Western moral philosophy over the last 2.5 millennia. So what is it to talk about our notions of a good life? And what I want to argue is that those notions of good, and this I'm going to follow Charles Taylor in this, are central to our notions of self and central to the process of what education is about. It's absolutely critical, intimately connected to what life, deciding what kind of a life is worthwhile and valuable, finding what who you are and what's important to you is a core part of what the educational process is about. It's not simply about allocating people into the labour market or preparing them for a particular lifetime occupation. So where do we go from here? This is Charles Taylor, author of a book that I constantly find myself going back to called Sources of the Self. It's a history of Western moral philosophy from the Greeks onwards in many ways, with a particular focus on the last 300-400 years. What Taylor argues is that notions of the good, forming the notion of the good, is a central part of who we are, of self-definition, of defining the self. In fact, it's impossible to have a sense of who we are without at the same time having a sense of what is valuable to us. What is valuable to us is helps constitute our identity, our sense of self, our sense of place, our narrative, a biography that we create over time. And in this book, he sort of unravels this issue again and again and again, how important it is to have a coherent sense of good to in order for us to have a coherent sense of self. And that this is an unfolding story. It's a story that we talk to ourselves every day about what's valuable to me, and it becomes a part of the narrative of the self that we develop over time. Okay, given that framework, given that broad philosophical framework, what do young people in Australia want? And I'm going to offer some data. I don't have data from Australia to talk about, but I'm going to talk about some data from Singapore. I have similar or comparable data in some ways from Tasmania that I collected about 4 years ago, but it's not quite comparable and it doesn't quite do the work that I want this table to do. So I'm going to report on some results. This is a survey of 10,000 year, the equivalent to a year 11 students in Singapore. It was a representative sample, and we asked them to assess, to indicate how important some 32, 33 items were in their lives. And this is a rank ordering of their life, their aspirations, what it is that defines their good. Now, you can see, and in Singapore, as in most Asian countries, there's a strong sense upon that a key moral value and aspiration is about taking care of the parents. That's beginning to weaken now, and there's a great deal of policy debate in Singapore, for example, about this issue. It's called filial piety. Now, when I talk about these results in Singapore, the audience, if they're older, always feel immensely relieved at the first finding, taking care of your parents. Particularly because the social security system there is not as extensive as it is here. But I've highlighted a number of items: to respect myself, to have a sense of meaning and purpose in life, to have a sense of achievement, to make my own choices, to figure out who I am, to set my own goals. You'll notice that I've highlighted these, and that also of the top 11, six of them configure or co-vary around what we in analysis described as a set of existential aspirations. What's important? And if you go through the list, all the way through from all of those existential aspirations to educational aspirations, to work aspirations, to family aspirations, to religious aspirations, all the way down to eating at expensive restaurants, this came as a shock to people in Singapore because Singaporeans tend to self-define themselves as compulsive shoppers. So those of you who've been to Singapore and walked down Orchard Road, you'll understand why. But to my amazement and to the amazement of everybody else, this group of Year 11 students said, no, it's not really important at all. We do it, but it's not central to how we define ourselves and our futures. So we did some factor analysis, and not only did we find that those aspirations were, those existential aspirations that I've listed here, were the highest mean scores, we also found that the pattern of covariance was the most coherent. It was by far and away the strongest set of single factor in the range of factors that we found across the 32 or 33 items. So it had among the highest mean scores, and it had the least covariance. It was a very powerful scale, so we call the existential aspiration scale. The alpha is a measure of the degree of covariance. Anything over 0.7 is considered very good. Anything over 0.9 is, you know, over the moon. So it's a very, very strong coherent scale. We also found that, and this surprised us immensely, we also found that these aspirations did not vary in any statistically significant way by social class, by gender, by race, by primary school attainment, secondary school experience, or secondary school attainment. At the end of primary six, kids do the PSLE in Singapore, which then allocates them into secondary school streams. At the end of secondary school, they do the O-levels, and that allocates them into the post-secondary institutions. Now, we found that there were no differences. We thought there'd be significant class differences, even race differences. None. No differences at all that were statistically significant. So, broadly speaking, those aspirations here are shared by kids from every social background. Now, I don't know, we don't have data, I have similar data from Australia, that's only partial. And what I do know is that we've got similar results. I didn't use the Australian data because it's not as comprehensive. But we have similar result data from Tasmania, from 2002. So I think this gives us a sense of what it is that matters to young people in a very fundamental sense about what defines a good life. I also did some statistical analysis on the relationship between these issues to test some of Taylor's arguments out, and found that his philosophical argument, in fact, can be supported empirically by the character of the relationships between these items.